Hello. Welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thank you for tuning in. Today we will continue our reading of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. It was published in 1889, became an instant success, and has never been out of print. The book has been categorized as a comic travelogue, perhaps the first. As our musical touchstone to accompany this reading, we will use Peter Dawson's rendition of Old Father Thames, recorded in 1933. There will be 17 episodes in this presentation, read to you by Bruce Carlson. Please join me now for episode 2 of Three Men in a Boat.
Harris said, "How about when it rains?" You can never rouse Harris. There's no poetry about Harris, no wild yearning for the unattainable. Harris never weeps. He knows not why. If Harris's eyes filled with tears, you can bet it's because Harris has been eating raw onions, or has put too much Worcestershire over his chop. If you were to stand at night by the seashore with Harris and say, "Hark, do you not hear? Is it but the mermaid singing deep below the waving waters, or sad spirits chanting dirges for white corpses held by seaweed?" Harris would take you by the arm and say, "I know what it is, old man, you've got a chill. Now you come along with me. I know a place round the corner here where you can get a drop of the finest drinks you ever tasted, put you right in less than no time." Harris always does know a place around the corner where you can get something brilliant in the beverages. I believe that if you meet Harris up in Paradise, supposing such a thing likely, he would immediately greet you with, "So glad you've come, old fellow. I've found a nice place around the corner here where you can get some really first-class nectar." In the present instance, however, as regarded the camping out, his practical view of the matter came as a very timely hint. Camping out in rainy weather is not so pleasant. It is evening. You are wet through, and there is a good 2 inches of water in the boat, and all things are damp. You find a place in the banks that is not quite so puddly as other places you have seen, and you land and lug out the tent, and two of you proceed to fix it. It is soaked and heavy, and it flops about and tumbles down on you and clings round your head and makes you mad. The rain is pouring steadily down all this time. It is difficult enough to fix a tent in dry weather. In wet, the task becomes Herculean. Instead of helping you, it seems to you that the other man is simply playing the fool. Just as you get your side beautifully fixed, he gives it a hoist from his end and spoils it all. "Here, what are you up to?" you call out. "What are you up to?" he retorts. "Let go, can't you?" "Don't pull it. You got it all wrong, you stupid ass," you shout. "No, I haven't," he yells back. "Let go your side." "I tell you, you've got it all wrong," you roar, wishing that you could get at him, and you give your ropes a tug that pulls all his pegs out. "Ah, the bally idiot," you hear him mutter to himself, and then comes the savage haul, and away goes your side. You lay down the mallet and start to go around and tell him what you think about the whole business, and at the same time he starts round in the same direction to come and explain his views to you. And you follow each other round and round, swearing at one another until the tent tumbles down in a heap and leaves you looking at each other across its ruins, when you both indignantly exclaim in the same breath, "There you are! What did I tell you?" Meanwhile, the third man, who has been bailing out the boat, and who has spilled the water down his sleeve, and has been cursing away to himself steadily for the last 10 minutes, wants to know what the thundering blazes you're playing at, and why the blamed tent isn't up yet. At last, somehow or other, it goes up, and you land the things. It is hopeless attempting to make a wood fire, so you light the mentholated spirit stove, and crowd around that. Rainwater is the chief article of diet at supper. Bread is 2/3 rainwater. the pie is exceedingly rich in it, and the jam, the butter, and the salt, and the coffee have all combined with it to make soup. There you dream that an elephant has suddenly sat down upon your chest, and that the volcano has exploded and thrown you down to the bottom of the sea, the elephant still sleeping peacefully on your bosom. You wake up and grasp the idea that something terrible really has happened. Your first impression is the end of the world has come, and then you think that this cannot be, that it is thieves and murderers or else fire, and this opinion you express in the usual method. No help comes, however, and all you know is that thousands of people are kicking you and you are being smothered. Somebody else seems to be in trouble, too. You can hear his faint cries coming from underneath your bed. Determining, at all events, to sell your life dearly, you struggle frantically, hitting out right and left with arms and legs, and yelling lustily the while, and at last something gives way, and you find your head in fresh air. 2 feet off, you dimly observe a half-dressed ruffian waiting to kill you, and you are prepared for a life-and-death struggle with him when it begins to dawn upon you that it's Jim. "Oh, it's you, is it?" he says, recognizing you at the same moment. "Yes," you answer, rubbing your eyes. "What's happened?"
"Bally tent blown down, I think," he says. "Where's Bill?"
When you both raise up your voices and shout for Bill, and the ground beneath you heaves and rocks, and the muffled voice that you heard before replies from out the ruin,
"Get off my head, can't you?"
And Bill struggles out, a muddy, trampled wreck, and in an unnecessarily aggressive mood, he begins, under the evident belief that the whole thing has been done on purpose. In the morning, you are all three speechless, owing to having caught severe colds in the night. You also feel very quarrelsome, and you swear at each other in hoarse whispers during the whole of breakfast time. We therefore decided that we would sleep out on fine nights, and hotel it, and inn it, and pub it, like respectable folks, when it was wet, or when we felt inclined for a change. Montmorency hailed this compromise with much approval. He does not revel in romantic solitude. Give him something noisy, and if a trifle low, so much the jollier. To look at Montmorency, you would imagine that he was an angel sent upon the earth, for some reason withheld from mankind, in the shape of a small fox terrier. There is a sort of, "Oh, what a wicked world this is, and how I wish I could do something to make it better and nobler," expression about Montmorency. That has always been known to bring the tears to the eyes of the pious old ladies and gentlemen. When first he came to live at my expense, I never thought I should be able to get him to stop long. I used to sit down and look at him as he sat on the rug and looked up at me and think, "Oh, that dog will never live. He will be snatched up in the bright skies in a chariot. That is what will happen to him." But when I had paid for about a dozen chickens that he had killed, and had dragged him growling and kicking by the scruff of the neck out of 114 street fights, and had had a dead cat brought round for my inspection by an irate female who called me a murderer, and had been summoned by the man next door but one, for having a ferocious dog at large, that had kept him penned up in his own tool shed, afraid to venture his nose outside the door for over 2 hours on a cold night, and had learned that the gardener, unknown to myself, had won 30 shillings by backing him to kill rats against time. Then I began to think that maybe they had let him remain on earth for a bit longer after all. To hang about a stable and collect a gang of the most disreputable dogs to be found in the town, and lead them out to march around the slums to fight other disreputable dogs, is Montmorency's idea of life. And so, as I before observed, He gave to the suggestion of inns and pubs and hotels his most emphatic approbation. Having thus settled the sleeping arrangements to the satisfaction of all four of us, the only thing left to discuss was what we should take with us, and this we had begun to argue when Harris said he had had enough oratory for one night and proposed that we should go out and have a smile, saying that he had found a place around by the square where you could get a drop of Irish beverages worth drinking. George said he felt thirsty. I never knew George when he didn't. And as I had a presentiment that a little tea, warm with a slice of lemon, would do my complaint good, the debate was, by common assent, adjourned to the following night, and the assembly put on its hats and went out. Chapter 3. So on the following evening we again assembled to discuss and arrange our plans. Harris said, "Now the first thing to settle is what to take with us. Now, you get a bit of paper and write down, Jay, and you get the grocery catalog, George, and somebody give me a bit of pencil and I'll make out a list." That's Harris all over, so ready to take the burden of everything himself and put it on the backs of other people. He always reminded me of poor Uncle Podger. You never saw such a commotion up and down a house in all your life as when my Uncle Podger undertook to do a job. A picture would have come home from the frame makers and be standing in the dining room waiting to be put up. And Aunt Podger would ask what was to be done with it, and Uncle Podger would say, "Oh, you leave that to me. Don't you, any of you, worry yourselves about that. I'll do that." And then he would take off his coat and begin. He would send the girl out for sixes north of Nails, and then one of the boys after her to tell her what size to get, and for that he would gradually work down and start the whole house. "Now you go get me my hammer, Will," he would shout, "and you bring me the rule, Tom, and I shall want this stepladder, and I'd better have a kitchen chair, too. And Jim, you run round to Mr. Goggles and tell him kind regards and hopes his leg's better and will he lend him his spirit level. And don't you go, Maria, because I shall want somebody to hold me the light, and when the girl comes back she must go out again for a bit of picture cord. And Tom, where's Tom? Tom, you come here. I shall want you to hand me up the picture." And then he would lift up the picture and drop it, and it would come out of the frame, and he would try to save the glass and cut himself, and then he would spring around the room looking for his handkerchief. He would not find his handkerchief because it was in the pocket of the coat he had taken off, and he did not know where he had put the coat, and all the house had to leave off looking for his tools and start looking for his coat, while he would dance around hither them. "Doesn't anyone in the whole house know where my coat is? I never came across such a set in all my life. Upon my word, I didn't. Six of you, and you can't find a coat that I put down not 5 minutes ago. Well, of all the—" Then had to get up and find that he had been sitting on it, and would call out, "Oh, you can give it up. I found it myself now. Might just as well ask the cat to find anything as expect you people to find it." And when, after half an hour had been spent in tying up his finger, and a new glass had been got, and the tools and the ladder and the chair and the candle had been brought, he would have another go, the whole family, including the girl and the charwoman, standing round in a semicircle ready to help. Two people would have to hold the chair, and a third would help him up on it, and hold him there, and a fourth would hand him a nail, and a fifth would pass him up the hammer, and he would take hold of the nail and drop it. "There," he would say in an injured tone, "now the nail's gone." And we all would have to go down on our knees and grovel for it, while he would stand on the chair and grunt and want to know if he was to be kept there all evening. The nail would be found at last, but by that time he would have lost the hammer. "Where's the hammer? What did I do with the hammer? Great heavens!
Seven of you gaping around there, you don't know what I did with a hammer. We would find the hammer for him, and then he would have lost sight of the mark he had made on the wall where the nail was to go in, and each of us had to get up on the chair beside him and see if we could find it, and we would each discover it in a different place. And he would call us all fools, one after another, and tell us to get down. And he would take the rule and remeasure and find he wanted 31⅜ inches from the corner, and he would try to do it in his head and go mad. And we would all try to do it in our heads and all arrive at different results and sneer at one another. And in the general row, the original number would be forgotten, and Uncle Podger would have to measure it again. He would use a bit of string this time, and at the critical moment when the old fool was leaning over the chair at an angle of 45 and trying to reach a point 3 inches beyond what was possible for him to reach, the string would slip, and down he would slide on the piano, a really fine musical effect being produced by the suddenness with which his head and body struck all the notes at the same time. And Aunt Maria would say that she would not allow the children to stand around and hear such language. At last Uncle Podger would get the spot fixed again and put the point of the nail on it with his left hand and take the hammer in his right hand, and with the first blow he would smash his thumb and drop the hammer with a yell on somebody's toes. Aunt Maria would mildly observe that next time Uncle Podger was going to hammer a nail into the wall, she hoped he would let her know in time so that she could make arrangements to go spend a week with her mother while it was being done. "Oh, you woman, you make such a fuss over everything," Uncle Podger would reply, picking himself up. "Why, I like doing a little job of this sort." And then he would have another try, and at the second blow the nail would go clean through the plaster and half the hammer after it, and Uncle Podger would be precipitated against the wall with force nearly sufficient to flatten his nose. Then we had to find the rule and the string again, and a new hole was made, and about midnight the picture would be up, very crooked and insecure, the wall for yards around looking as if it had been smoothed down with a rake, and everybody dead beat and wretched except Uncle Podger. "There you are," he would say, stepping heavily off the chair onto the charwoman's corns and surveying the mess he had made with evident pride. "Why, some people would have had a man in to do a little thing like that." Harris will be just that sort of man when he grows up, I know, and I told him so. I said I could not permit him to take so much labor upon himself. I said, "No, you get the paper and pencil and the catalog, and George will write down, and I'll do the work." The first list we made had to be discarded. It was clear that the upper reaches of the Thames would not allow the navigation of a boat sufficiently large to take things we had set down as indispensable. So we tore that list up and looked at one another. George said, "You know, we are on a wrong tack altogether. We must not think of the things we could do with, but only of the things that we can't do without." George comes out really quite sensible at times. You'd be surprised. I call that downright wisdom, not merely as regards the present case, but with reference to our trip up the river of life generally. How many people on that voyage load up the boat till it is ever in danger of swamping with a store of foolish things which they think essential to the pleasure and comfort of the trip, but which are really only useless lumber? How they pile the little craft, mast high, with fine clothes and big houses, and with useless servants, and a host of swell friends that do not care tuppence for them, and that they do not care 3 halfpennies for, with expensive entertainments that nobody enjoys, with formalities and fashions with presence and ostentation, and with, oh, the heaviest, the maddest lumber of all, the dread of what will my neighbor think, with luxuries that only cloy, with pleasures that bore, with empty show that, like the criminal's iron crown of yore, makes to bleed and swoon the aching head that wears it. It is lumber, man, all lumber, throw it overboard, and makes the boat so heavy to pull you nearly faint at the oars. It makes it so cumbersome and dangerous to manage, you never know a moment's freedom from anxiety and care, never gain a moment's rest from the dreamy laziness, no time to watch the windy shadows skimming lightly over the shallows, or the glittering sunbeams flitting in and out among the ripples, or the great trees by the margin looking down at their own image, or the woods all green and golden, or the lilies in white and yellow and somber waving rushes, or the sedges, or the orchids, or the blue forget-me-nots. Throw the lumber overboard, man. Let your boat of life be light, packed with only what you need, homely home and simple pleasures, one or two friends worth the name, someone to love and someone to love you, a cat, a dog, and a pipe or two, enough to eat and enough to wear, and little more than enough to drink, for thirst is a dangerous thing. You will find the boat easier to pull then, and it will not be so liable to upset, and it will not matter so much if it does upset. Good plain merchandise will stand water. You will have time to think as well as to work, time to drink in life's sunshine, time to listen to the Folian music that the wind of God draws from the human heartstrings around us. Time to... I beg your pardon, really, I quite forgot. Well, we left the list to George, and he began it. We won't take a tent, suggested George. We will have a boat with a cover. It is ever so much simpler and more comfortable. It seemed a good thought, and we adopted it. I do not know whether you have ever seen the thing I meant. You fix iron hoops over the boat, and stretch a huge canvas over them, and fasten it down all round from stem to stern, and it covers the boat in a sort of little house, and it is beautifully cozy, though a trifle stuffy. But there, everything has its drawbacks, as the man said, when his mother-in-law died, and they came down upon him for the funeral expenses. George said that in that case we must take a rug each, a lamp, some soap, a brush and comb between us, a toothbrush each, a basin, some tooth powder, some shaving tackle. Sounds like a French exercise, doesn't it? And a couple of big towels for bathing. I noticed that people always make gigantic arrangements for bathing when they are going to be anywhere near the water, but that they don't bathe much when they get there. It is the same when you go to the seaside. I always determine when, thinking over the matter in London, that I'll get up early every morning and go and have a dip before breakfast, and I religiously pack up a pair of drawers with a bath towel. I always get red bathing drawers. I rather fancy myself in red drawers. They suit my complexion so. But when I get to the sea, I don't feel somehow that I want that early morning bath nearly so much as I did when I was in town. On the contrary, I feel more that I want to stay in bed till the last moment and then come down and have my breakfast. Once or twice virtue has triumphed, and I have got out at 6:30, dressed myself, and have taken my drawers and my towel and stumbled dismally off. But I haven't enjoyed it. They seem to keep a specially cutting east wind waiting for me when I go to bathe in the early morning, and they pick out all the three-cornered stones and put them on top, and they sharpen up the rocks and cover the points over with a bit of sand so that I can't see them, and they take the sea and they put it 2 miles out so that I have to huddle myself up in my arms and hop, shivering, through 6 inches of water. And when I do get to the sea, it is rough and quite insulting. One huge wave catches me up and chucks me in a sitting posture, as hard as ever it can, down onto a rock which has been put there for me. And before I've said, "Oh, ugh," and found out what has gone, the wave comes back and carries me out to mid-ocean. I begin to strike out frantically for the shore. I wonder if I shall ever see home and friends again, and wish I'd been kinder to my little sister when a boy. When I was a boy, I mean. Just then, I'd given up all hope. A wave retires and leaves me sprawling like a starfish on the sand, and I get up and look back and find that I've been swimming for my life in 2 feet of water. I hop back and dress and crawl home, where I have to pretend I liked it. In the present instance, we all talked as if we were going to have long swims every morning. George said it was so pleasant to wake up in the boat in the fresh morning and plunge into the limpid river. Harris said there was nothing like a swim before breakfast to give you an appetite. George said that if it was going to make Harris eat more than Harris ordinarily ate, then he should protest against Harris having a bath at all. He said that that would be quite enough hard work in towing sufficient food for Harris up against the stream as it was. I urged upon George, however, how much pleasanter it would be to have Harris clean and fresh about the boat, even if we did have to take a few more hundredweight of provisions, and he got to see it in my light and withdrew his opposition to Harris's bath. Agreed, finally, that we should take 3 bath towels so as not to keep each other waiting. For clothes, George said 2 suits of flannel should be sufficient, as we could wash them ourselves in the river when they got dirty. We asked him if he had ever tried washing flannels in the river, and he replied, "No, not exactly myself-like, but he knew some fellows who had, and it was easy enough, and Harris and I were weak enough to fancy he knew what he was talking about, and that 3 respectable young men, without position or influence and with no experience in washing, could really clean their own shirts and trousers in the River Thames with a bit of soap. We were to learn in the days to come, when it was too late, that George was a miserable impostor who could evidently have known nothing whatever about the matter. If you had seen these clothes after, but as the shilling shockers say, we anticipate." George impressed upon us to take a change of underthings and plenty of socks in case we got upset and wanted to change. Also, plenty of handkerchiefs, as they would do to wipe things, and a pair of leather boots as well as our boating shoes, as we could want them if we got lost or upset.
You have been listening to Episode 2 of 3 Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. Please remember that if you miss an episode, you can find it by going to our website, ktwh.org, and clicking on Programs, and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each week, we will post the episodes from the prior 2 weeks for you to catch up on. Please join me next time for Episode 3 of 3 Men in a Boat, here on Literally from the North Shore.